Pound of bacon, 2 pounds of butter, 2 loaves of bread, a large can of peas, quart of olive oil, can of sardines, and 1 pound of chopped meat. That'd be all, Mr. Douglas?
Yes, that's all.
That comes to $1.18.
$1.18?
Don't get mad at me. It ain't my doing. A wholesaler raises me, and I gotta raise you.
Yeah, well...
It's criminal the way prices are going up. You bought any gas lately? It's 13 cents a gallon now.
13?
Hey, you need anything else, Mr. Douglas?
No, thanks. That's all.
Oh, I almost forgot. There's a letter for you.
Oh?
Yeah, the way things are going up, I'm surprised folks are writing anymore. Huh. Writing paper's going up 5 cents a box. It's hard to get a bottle of ink for less than 4 cents. Oh, yeah. I hate to tell you what I have to charge for blotters. Have you bought any pen wipers lately?
No.
Well, don't.
Look, please have my letter.
Oh, yeah, there you are. The whole thing's getting out of hand. It's a good thing Coolidge didn't choose to run again, because I wouldn't have voted for it.
Yeah, I don't think I would either.
Mad Money Machine. Show 109. The fifth week of April. Yeah, hi everybody. This is Paul Douglas Boyer. Welcome to the Mad Money Machine Show 109. Thanks for joining me. Thanks for downloading into your computer, to your iPod, to your Zune, whatever. And I say fifth week of April because, yeah, I know there's actually five Fridays in May and only 4 Fridays in April. But I'm going to shift this show back to April since I did that one show about Davy Crockett. So I'm going to make 4 shows in April and 4 shows in May. I can do that because this is podcasting. The Madman Machine is proud to be sponsored by Index Funds Advisors. Take their risk capacity survey. Check them out on the website at ifa.com. Sign up for an account with them. Let them handle your financial freedom. Yeah, so Green Acres was on TV, I guess, about 40 years ago. I'm thinking 1968. And even then, they were joking about inflation. Well, today we can really see the rampant effects of inflation. People are starting to hoard things. Costco's running out of rice and soy oil and flour and things. Is it going to get better before it gets worse? What do you think? And how much worse does it have to get before people really start realizing what's going on? Can you imagine what it would look like if it were worse than it is today? What would happen if the dollar does fall by 50% against other currencies around the world? What would happen then? What would the price of oil be? What would the price of gasoline be? How much would it cost to go out to eat? So when the Fed lowers the interest rate by creating more money, the money is therefore worth less. The money is inflated. Prices of things naturally rise to accommodate this. It's an equilibrium. It's a balancing. Imagine a ball floating on the top of the water. You suddenly dump a lot more water into the pool. You might dump the water right on top of the ball, but the ball is eventually going to rise to the level of the water. It's the same thing with prices. You dump a lot more dollars into the dollar pool around the world, and prices will rise to match the level. Now, I see the president is on TV now talking about high energy and oil prices and high food prices and so forth. And one solution he puts forward is we should drill in Anwar. Well, you know, I think it's okay to go drilling other places, but I don't necessarily think that much excess supply is going to bring down the prices of oil. From what I've been reading, we're not in an oil shortage really right now. It's just that we're in a dollar surplus right now. The dollar doesn't buy as much oil anymore. Oil buys a lot more dollars, said another way. Yeah, sure, scarcity is a component of it, but I think the biggest component of it is inflation. And remember, the definition of inflation is an increase in the supply of money. A result of inflation is higher prices. Let's get that straight. And speaking of Green Acres, I wonder if you've ever heard this take on the Green Acres theme. Sing along if you know the words.
Green Acres is the place to be. Farm living is the life for me. Land spreading out so far and wide. Keep Manhattan, just give me that countryside. New York is where I'd rather stay. Penthouse view. Darling, I love you, but give me Park Avenue. The chores, the stores, fresh air, Times Square. You are my wife. Goodbye, city life.
How completely and utterly embarrassing. Apologies to Jimi Hendrix, apologies to Eddie Albert and Ava Gabor, and apologies to you, the listener. Well, you know how I mentioned on the last show that I got a $50 rebate back from Amazon for buying an HD DVD player that plays nothing anymore. And I spent it on three books. I got those books pretty quickly, and I've actually finished reading one of those books. The book is called The Revolution, A Manifesto by Ron Paul. And pretty good book. I think I've been following him so closely, though, I think I've heard about everything in the book said already. Some of the details are expanded a little bit. But for example, very first chapter, The False Choices of American Politics, he talks about how the choices that we have to vote for really don't give us very good choices after all. He says the supposedly conservative candidate tells us about waste in government and ticks off about $10 million in frivolous pork barrel projects that outrage him. The inevitable Bridge to Nowhere project, or study the effects of celery consumption on arresting memory loss in order to elicit laughter and applause from partisan audiences. All right, so that's 0.00045% of the federal budget dealt with. What does he propose to do with the other 99.99955% in order to return our country to living within its means? Not a word. Those same silly three or four programs will be brought up all campaign long, and that's all we'll ever hear about where the candidate stands on spending. But conservatives are told they must support these candidates, and so they do, hoping for the best, and nothing changes. And later and then, in Chapter 6, called Money, the Forbidden Issue in American Politics, he starts out, Americans are concerned about our financial picture, the housing bubble, the collapsing dollar, the specter of inflation. Most don't know what's causing it, but they correctly sense that something in our economic system is rotten. Neither political party will speak to them frankly and honestly. Instead, the people are told by the talking heads on television that their rulers know just what is wrong and they'll promptly put things right. A little more monetary manipulation by the Federal Reserve is all the economy needs, and there's nothing fundamentally wrong with the system. These contrived, self-serving answers satisfy very few, but they're all the answers the American people are ever given. In the year 2000, I wrote, "The relative soundness of our currency that we enjoy as we move into the 21st century will not persist. The instability in world currency markets, because of the dollar's acceptance for so many years as a reserve currency, will cause devastating adjustments that Congress will eventually be forced to deal with. As 2007-2008 wore on, the precipitous decline of the dollar dramatically undercut all the promises and assurances that the system was just fine. It wasn't. And he goes on to talk about how we now have this fiat currency. The Constitution makes clear that we should only allow gold to be money. Talks about the hidden inflation tax. Talks about the measures of inflation, the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, which is misleading. And to conclude the chapter, he says, so what should be done? He says, first of all, it's long past time to put monetary issue back on the table as a subject for genuine discussion, and then to start asking some forbidden questions. He says, for most people, in fact, the Fed is a complete mystery, its operations incomprehensible. That seems to be just the way the Fed likes it. We're supposed to be bored by it. We're supposed to treat it as a given, like the air we breathe. We're supposed to have confidence in it. Surely the experts who run our monetary system for us, and of course who have a vested interest in perpetuating the system we now have, couldn't be giving us bad advice. It's time for fresh thinking for a change. A reappraisal of a monetary system that's presented to us as the best of all possible worlds, but whose dangers grow clearer and more urgent with each passing day. First, he recommends is to legalize competition. Restore to the Americans the right to use precious metals as a medium of exchange. And so one of the aspects of that is to remove capital gains taxes on precious metals. Because right now, if you make a transaction using gold, you're taxed on the gain that you might have in gold, which is kind of silly. Why don't we get a tax rebate on the loss of the value of the dollar? But I did finish reading that other book I mentioned, Gold, the Once and Future Money. And one of the key things I came away with from that book was a gold standard, at least in this author's opinion, doesn't mean every single dollar is convertible into a piece of gold at a bank. It just means that the standard value of the dollar is held to the same value of gold. And so the book actually kind of suggests that you don't even really need a large reserve of gold in the nation to be on a gold standard. It's just you're keeping the value of the dollar standard with the value of gold. And you do that by increasing or decreasing the supply of money in the system, just like they do now. What do we have now? Well, we have an interest rate standard right now. And of course, that standard shifts up and down on their whim. But they manage the supply of money in such a way as to keep this interest rate at a certain targeted level. And if you just simply accept the fact that the dollar is going to be held to the value of gold, then you don't need to worry about all these Fed board governors deciding which way the interest rate should go and all this sort of stuff. You let a computer calculate how much money you need in the system to equal a certain dollar value of gold. Of course, if you start, and it's something that you could actually start tomorrow. You just simply say, all right, you pick a number. All right, $900 is worth an ounce of gold. And you go with that. And then from then on out, what's the price of gold? $900 an ounce. And if you remember, it used to be that way in the early 20th century. Started out as $20 an ounce. Then they raised it to $35 an ounce. Ah, how'd they do that? By printing a lot more money. Well, it's a pretty good book. It's number one at Amazon, and it'll be number seven in the New York Times this Sunday. If you want to know what the revolution is all about and you want to sign up, get a copy of the book and then join the revolution. Okay, so here's another thing. I go to buy some new earbuds for my iPod, right? And they come in all kinds of colors. You've got the standard Apple white, the ubiquitous, the iconic white-colored earbuds, earphones for your listening to your iPod. Most everybody else's comes in black. I even seen some that come in green and blue and purple and red and yellow and all these colors. Why can't I find them that come in tan-colored? You know, that match the color of my skin so that when I have these things in my ear that it's not immediately noticeable. I mean, TV broadcasters have these ear things in their ear that you can't hardly see. They match the color of their ear. Why can't I get these for my iPod? I've looked all over the internet even for this sort of stuff. It just makes sense. you know, you talk, I've heard stories about thefts of iPods and muggings and things. People see these white earbuds in somebody's ear and they know they've got an iPod, and so they're a target. Well, if you had tan colored earbuds, it wouldn't be as immediately noticeable, now would it? Let's play a round of the world's favorite game, Guru Roulette. I've replaced the numbers on a roulette wheel with the names of investment gurus. I'll spin the wheel and roll the marble, and for the selected guru, give you a little background on their investment philosophy. So here we go. And the winner this time on Mad Men Machine Show 109 is Eric Beinhocker. Eric D. Beinhocker is a senior advisor to McKinsey & Company. Fortune magazine named him business leader of the next century, and his writings on business and economics have appeared in a variety of publications, including the Financial Times. And I've just finished reading his book from 2006 entitled The Origin of Wealth, Evolution, Complexity, and the Radical Remaking of Economics. Here's the basic idea. Economics for the past 100 years has been focused on equilibrium, keeping things in balance. Push on the economy in one direction, it pops out the other side, right? Well, Beinhocker looks at economics as a complex adaptive system, and he says the way that economies form is through evolution. And for something to succeed through evolution, it needs to fit well against a given fitness function. Just like an animal in an environment, the animal adapts to survive and thrive in that environment. And of course, much the same with any business or society. Given a certain fitness function, the business will either survive or die. One of the interesting metaphors or analogies that he uses in the book is, he says, imagine all possible 500-page books. He says, take a book that's 500 pages in size exactly. Compute every possible combination of letters and blank spaces and special characters that might fit on a page, and then 500 pages in this book. The first book would, of course, be the letter A followed by complete blanks for the next 499 pages, and then the letter B in all blanks. He says this collection of books would be unfathomably enormous. It's like 10 to the millionth power, larger than anything in all the known universe. But that library, which he, by the way, calls the Smith Library after Adam Smith, contains every book that's ever been written and ever will be written. Even if a book is larger than 500 pages, you can figure that you can take two or more volumes together to make a book that's longer than 500 pages. Of course, this set of books that have already been written would be infinitesimally small compared to the entire 10 to the millionth power books that are possible. All the works of Shakespeare, in fact, every work of Shakespeare, every letter in every word of the work of Shakespeare has a typo in it, every possible typo, just to get your mind around how unfathomably large this set is. But the point is, every possible business plan is also in that set of the Smith Library. And now we need somebody to read all of these business plans and pick out which one is the best. That's the fitness function, the unwinding of the information to see how well it meets its criteria. His thesis is basically, of course, the title of this is The Origin of Wealth. He says that evolution in this manner, matching fitness functions against business plans, is what creates wealth. Of course, a business plan might be used to create a new physical technology, or it might be used to create new social technologies, you know, laws and the structure of organizations and so forth. He says in prehistoric or early historical times, the fitness function was the big men, the key rulers of the tribe. They decided what the fitness function was. But later, more recently, it's been markets that have decided the fitness function. And in the last chapter, he has this sentence: the key distinction between a capitalist and a socialist economy from a complexity economics perspective is whether the ultimate arbiter of economic fitness is a market or a hierarchy. And he goes on to critique both the left and the right and says complexity economics, if we understand it, sort of supersedes the ideas of the left and the right. This is a really interesting book full of modern ideas about, you know, it uses techniques brought in from advanced computer science, I think, and applies it to economics. I'm glad I read this book, and I hope I can remember 1/100th of it. Got my copy out of the library. Congratulations, Eric Beinhocker. You're the guru on Madman Machine 109. Got an email from Richard. Says, Dear Paul, love the podcast. You converted me from an active investor to a passive one. And boy, am I so happy about it these days. I was barely keeping up before, but now I know I'm actually doing better than most investors, mostly. I max out my Keo each year, but unfortunately the funds are limited to Alliance Bernstein funds, and besides being actively managed, these funds seem really lame. I have suggested if we could move to Vanguard, but don't think it'll happen. My wife and I have almost as much money in our IRAs, which we max out every year. Our IRAs have about 50% in the total stock market index and 50% in the total international stock market index, plus a couple thousand in Apple, Google, and Toyota. I know, but they're all I have left from my active investor days, and they're fun to watch. I have very little invested in those compared to the index funds. My question is, if I have to stay in the Alliance Bernstein funds, how would I choose which fund to be in? Any help is appreciated. I'm 42. My wife's 50. We live fairly cheaply and like to save. Well, congratulations, Richard, for being wise to the ways of active investing and walking down the 12-step path of being a passive investor. I suppose, you know, I'm not really too familiar with a Keo plan. I guess it's the same as 401k type plan, right? First thing I would suggest is look at all the Alliance Bernstein funds in the plan and look at their expense ratios. Try to pick one with the lowest expense ratio. Try to pick one that is the least actively managed, if you can. Perhaps look at the turnover ratio in each fund. A high turnover ratio indicates there's a whole lot of actively managing going on. A way to look at these is go to Morningstar.com and type in the ticker symbols of each fund, of course. The other suggestion I would have is there a way to get out of your Keo plan and transfer it into an IRA? I know in our case, the way to get out of our 401k plan was to quit the company. We didn't quit the company in order to get out of the 401k, but I mean, you know, maybe there's a case for some people that it makes sense to do that. Depending on how high your 401k gets, that's money you're going to want to be living off of someday. And like we talked about on the last show, that 1.5% difference each year can make a whopping difference when you go out 20 and 30 years. Maybe quit and come back. And finally, I would say, well, look at your entire net worth. Look at the total portfolio of everything you own. You mentioned you own half total U.S. stock market and half total international stock market. Well, where are the REITs? Where are the emerging markets? How about small cap and value funds? Maybe look at Alliance Bernstein to help supplement those categories for you in those indices, in those asset allocation categories. Thanks for the email, Richard. Best of luck to you. Stay invested. Let's pull something out of the Mad Money Machine tool crib. All right, I got a couple of loose things laying around on the floor that I want to pull out of the tool crib and clean up the tool crib. It's spring cleaning time in the tool crib. And these two things I don't actually recommend very highly. But if you're the kind of person that's interested in this stuff, then pay attention. The first one is, it's for all you active traders out there. You can get online a free copy, PDF copy, of Reminiscences of a Stock Operator by Edwin Lefebvre. This is the book written in 1923. And it's all about Jesse Livermore, supposedly the greatest stock trader of all time. Well, if he's so great, why did he commit suicide? But here are some quotes attributed to Jesse Livermore. All through time, people have basically acted and reacted the same way in the market as a result of greed, fear, ignorance, and hope. That is why the numerical formulations and patterns recur on a constant basis. Well, I think the academics have disproven this now, that there are no recurring patterns in the stock market. Second quote is, the game of speculation is the most uniformly fascinating game in the world. But it is not a game for the stupid, the mentally lazy, the person of inferior emotional balance, or the get-rich-quick adventurer. They will die poor. Well, you know what? Actually, they found that people that have inferior emotional balance are actually the better stock traders. These are people that are emotionally detached from stocks and the market. They actually have better speculation skills than people that try to put some intelligence into the game and get all wrapped up in their emotion and so forth. So that's the first tool. The second tool comes recommended in an email. Covestor.com. The website says, the real trade sharing service. The smartest investors aren't all portfolio money managers. Every day, adept, unsalaried players around the world are matching or beating results of the pros. We think it's high time for these unsung investment talents to get more recognition, more resources, more of the rewards. Well, I'm actually kind of scared of this website because it actually apparently ties into your actual brokerage account and monitors what you're trading and then posts results on the website, you know, along with the Sharpe ratio and things, but your return and your Sharpe ratio and the risk that you're taking, and then it ranks people. Well, to me, this is akin to posting results of roulette wheel players. And let's see who is the best roulette wheel player in the world. And let's rank them according to their plays. And what numbers did they pick? And what was their strategy for picking numbers? Or did they pick black versus red? Or did they pick only red numbers or black numbers? And let's rank them and put the ones on top that are the best roulette wheel players. And at the end of the day, what do you got? You got somebody that got lucky. Time and time again. Yeah, they're really, really lucky. These people are really lucky. But there's nothing to say that they're going to be lucky the next time they play roulette. And there's certainly nothing to say that if you try to follow their roulette wheel playing strategies, that you'll have any better or the same amount of luck that they had. Ah, the tool crib is looking a lot cleaner now. Well, there's some tools out of the tool crib swept up from the floor on Mad Men Machine Show 109. First one's free. The second one, not so much. Let's go browsing out at foliodex.com and take a look at some of the portfolios and how they're doing out there. The Cramer 2008 Stability Portfolio is way on top of everybody else, but I think it's coming down from its highs recently. Amazingly, it has a very high Sharpe ratio, which means his five stock picks swing in and out of each other pretty well, I guess. The Mr. Sharpe portfolio continues to do well, the one that I added that has basically three funds, half a international bond, a quarter the Vanguard Precious Metals and Mining Fund, and a quarter the Vanguard Energy Fund. Very specialized funds there. Also has a very high Sharpe ratio, but I added one recently, and this one comes from Agora Financial. I call it the Hard Times portfolio. They recently came out with a newsletter recommending... suggesting that a whole lot of bad things are going to happen in the marketplace. They suggested buying puts, in other words, options to sell short the REITs, the IYR, and also the transports. They picked a bear mutual fund, a bear bond fund called the Bear High Yield Bond, AFBIX ticker symbol. They recommend investing strongly into Japan, EWJ, JEQ, JOF, those types of things. And they recommended a Canadian Energy Trust, the Advantage Energy Income, AAV. They recommend buying puts on the Financials Index Fund, the XLF. They recommend an inverse bond fund. So when bonds go up, this fund go, or rather when bonds go, yeah, when bonds go up, this fund goes down. When bonds go down, which they think is going to happen, this fund goes up. Also, there's a weakening dollar 2X mutual fund. So as the dollar weakens, this fund goes up twice as much, RYWDX. And finally, they recommend, a couple more things in the dying dollar category. They recommend buying call options, long call options, January 2010 on the GDX, the Gold Miners Fund, Index Fund. And they're recommending putting some money in silver. And the easy way to do that is SLV. Well, I will be tracking a portfolio made up of some of these funds and index funds. I don't think I'm going to track the put and call options. But I put the mutual funds and the stock index funds into this portfolio that we'll track out at FolioDex. Now, one thing to be cautious of is the actual portfolio, I don't really start that until April the 28th, because they didn't recommend it until April 25th. The returns that are shown out there, though, start at the beginning of the year or for the previous 3 months. So we'll have to wait a few months until we see how their recommendation actually performed since they recommended it. Got an email a few months ago from Dave in Ontario, Canada, says, "Hi, Paul. Love the show. I appreciate the advice you give and the reasons behind investing passively. I'm 28 and I'm using a Canadian version of the couch potato portfolio in my retirement fund. You, along with a couple of books I've read, convinced me that trying to beat the market is not worth it and is not a feasible goal to have over the long run. I'm 28 now and have a goal to retire by 52. Guess we'll see how that goes." And then he says, "Just a quick note on an Xbox arcade game that I really liked, and if you have time, might be worth checking out, Poker Smash. Check out the demo. Neat little puzzle game. Take it easy, Dave, in Canada." Oh, by the way, on our cruise to Bermuda, we met some folks from Canada, and it was fun chatting with them. But yeah, Dave, I mean, if you have your portfolio set up correctly, and you keep adding to it properly and a proper asset allocation, then retiring by 52, it's definitely doable. Keep your expenses low, keep investing right, asset allocation properly. You could do it. But you know what word I like to use a lot better than retirement? Because retirement to me just gives me images of quitting work altogether, sitting around and doing nothing but watch TV all the time. I like to use the word financial freedom. You are free to do with your time whatever you like. And I'm thinking that more and more people are going to start liking contributing to the world, whether or not they make money doing it. And if you make a little bit of money, well, every little bit helps, doesn't it? And if you find something you're really engaged in and gives you pleasure doing, then you can do that from 52 to 132. It's really the best of all worlds, isn't it? Making money while enjoying, just loving what you do. Just like Warren Buffett. On the previous show, show 108, I asked you to imagine a scenario at which at your retirement party at age 65, you had two envelopes with two different 401k statements in it, and you get to choose which one to pick. Well, I'd like to pose a similar scenario for you this week. Imagine that you're 65 years old now, and you have the opportunity to look over a time record of your previous years from now till the age 65. All right, so if you're 25, then you look over the past 40 years of all the time you've spent doing things. On the one record, you see that you've done what Jim Cramer recommends, and that is spend an hour a week per stock that you own. And he recommends, of course, to be diversified, a minimum of 5 stocks. So let's say 40 years times 52 weeks times 5 hours is 10,400 hours you spent researching stocks. The second sheet says that you spent 40 hours looking at your stocks. The first sheet, by the way, shows that you have X amount of dollars. The second sheet, in all probability, shows that you have X plus Y amount of dollars. So in the first case, you spent tremendous amount of time and ended up with some dollars. In the second case, you spent almost no time and ended up with even more money, in all likelihood. I think you'd have to agree that you'd pick that second scenario, wouldn't you? And that second scenario comes about, I believe, if you invest your money with index funds advisors. Let them worry about the rebalancing. Let them put it in all markets across the globe. Let them help you determine your risk capacity, your capacity for risk. Let them help you decide how much to put into large cap, small cap, emerging markets, international markets, and bonds, various bond funds. And then with those 10,000 hours, practice the piano or the guitar or learn a new language. And when you're 65, with that extra money, you can travel to the country and practice that language. Or you go to Starbucks and play the guitar. Well, thank you so very much for joining me this week on the Mad Money Machine. This is Paul Douglas Boyer saying it takes money to make money, and it takes green acres to make a Mad Money Machine. I'll see you next Friday for the first show of May. In the meantime, sign up with an account at IFA.com, Index Funds Advisors. Let them help you manage your financial freedom. Get yourself into some of those Dimensional Fund Advisors index funds as soon as possible. Some music on this program provided by music.mevio.com. I would like your feedback emailed to me. Where else? Feedback@madmoneymachine.com or call the voicemail line 206-734-4763. Leave comments in the show notes or see me at twitter.com/madmoneymachine. Stay invested, everybody.